You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, in for Rob Ferret. Coming up, a guest political scientist joins us to talk about how the modern American presidential campaign got to be so long. Now, 11 young people across Wisconsin have been hospitalized with symptoms of severe lung disease, and state health officials say that even though they're still investigating the cause, all of them have reported vaping recently. The State Department of Health Services says there are seven more young people who are being investigated who may also be involved. And now the Federal Centers for Disease Control and Prevention has joined the effort to figure out what's going on. Tom Haupt is a respiratory disease epidemiologist at the Wisconsin Department of Health Services and part of the department's team investigating this. Tom, welcome back to Central Time.
Well, thank you much, Judith, and thank you for letting us get our message out. We really do appreciate it.
Sure. And Spencer Straub is the agency's media and communications coordinator for the Tobacco Prevention and Control Program. Spencer, thank you for joining us.
Hi, Judith. Thanks for having me.
Let's start with you, Tom. Can you tell us about the symptoms these young people were coming into the hospital with?
Yes, it's a very severe and abrupt onset of respiratory distress. Coughing, fatigue, chest pain, and many of these patients actually have had a history of significant weight loss in the previous several weeks before their onset of illness. So it's something that, again, it's a very severe disease. We don't know what the long-lasting effects are, but these are younger people who don't have any underlying illnesses and shouldn't be susceptible to such a severe illness.
And Tom, these are not young people who are clustered in one community. Can you tell us where these cases have been identified?
Yes, the counties, there's numerous counties involved. That includes Door County, Racine, Walworth, Dodge County, Waukesha, and Winnebago. There has been a lot of cases in the southeastern part of Wisconsin, but there has been throughout the state as well. And we continue to get reports from the astute clinicians who really have stepped up and helped us to identify further cases.
What do we know about the current condition of these young people?
Well, they've all been responding very well to steroids, and we were doing some checking. I'm not sure how many people are still in the hospital, but the vast majority of our 11 cases have been discharged, are doing well. We're obviously waiting for the follow-up reports to come up to interpret and figure out what the long-lasting effects are on their lungs. Hopefully, it's nothing significant.
And we've been saying young people. What is the range of ages of those who have been hospitalized?
Their age ranges is from 16 to 26, but the vast majority have been teenagers, 16, 17, 18-year-olds, a couple of young adults.
And Spencer, let's turn to you. Can you remind us what we're seeing in terms of the popularity of using vaping products among young people in Wisconsin?
Yeah, sure. Absolutely, Judith. So we've seen a really disturbing trend both in Wisconsin and nationally of youth increasingly turning to these products. So to give you a sense of how much this has jumped up, in 2014, around 8% of high school students were using e-cigarettes, and now it's 20%. So about 1 in 5 high school students are using e-cigarettes. We've seen a big jump as well amongst middle school users. Back in 2014, it was basically 1% of middle school users. Now it's 4% of middle school students are using e-cigarettes, and 1 in 9 middle school students have tried them. So we're definitely seeing a sharp rise in terms of use among young people.
I think, Spencer, in kind of just, you know, common conversation, there's a sense that maybe vaping or e-cigarettes aren't as dangerous as real cigarettes, real tobacco products. Can you tell us, for those of us who have not been around it as much, what does vaping entail, really?
Yeah, sure. There are some concerns with e-cigarette products, particularly in regards to youth. And so when we look at youth vaping and youth e-cigarette use, I think the things that we want to look out for are, one, that by and large, these products all contain nicotine. And nicotine is a highly addictive substance. We know that among adolescents, it can harm brain development. It impacts learning, memory, and attention. We also know that the aerosol from it is not harmless either. It can contain harmful substances and heavy metals like nickel, tin, and lead. So it's definitely something that we want to discourage youth, particularly from using, because the one other piece is that it can the use of e-cigarettes can make youth more likely to go on to using regular cigarettes.
And are e-cigarette materials and vaping materials as controlled as traditional tobacco products?
Not currently, no. There is a process that is in place through the FDA where they are taking applications for the products to go under FDA review, but that process is still going to be that process is still at least a couple of years out. So right now we are a little bit in the Wild West in terms of e-cigarettes.
And does that mean that young people can buy it easily, or are you talking more about like quality assurance?
I was speaking more to quality assurance.
But for ages, is it the same age limits on buying those materials as, say, a pack of cigarettes?
Yeah, 18 is the age right now for both vapor products and for conventional tobacco products.
We're talking with Tom Haupt right now and also Spencer Straub. They are both with the Wisconsin Department of Health Services. We're talking about a rash of young people who are being hospitalized with severe lung disease, and it seems that the common element in their experiences is vaping. And Tom, let's talk about where the investigation stands right now. How does the department try to narrow down what the actual vector might be for this?
Sure. We have a team of investigators who are actually conducting interviews with all the patients, so with all 11 confirmed cases and at least 7 others who are suspect at this point. We have not yet identified a common source. We're looking into trying to keep our eyes and ears open for any new developments that may have come about. We don't have a product yet, but again, we have a source of at least 4 or 5 investigators who are talking directly to these young adults and teens.
And as we said, Tom, this is not very localized in one part of Wisconsin, so it seems like this could maybe be happening elsewhere. Are you hearing anything from other states? Because this seems like it came up pretty quickly in Wisconsin.
It has, and we do know for a fact that the Illinois Department of Health did put out a press release that they had 2 cases that were very similar. And again, their investigation is going on with those 2 patients as well to see if there's any commonalities with the patients from Wisconsin. But that's the only other state that we're aware of at this point that has identified cases. We did reach out to all our neighboring states to notify them, let them know what we're going through over here to, again, make a call for cases that may be very similar.
Spencer, some people may be hearing this and be worried about someone they know who uses e-cigarettes or vaping products, or might be worried about young people in their lives who, as is often the case, have not shared with adults that they are using these products. What is the department advising people who use these products to do?
Well, I think when we look at the use of tobacco products and quitting the use of tobacco products, we know that there are proven ways to do so. We know that there are FDA-approved medications like nicotine gum, lozenge, and patch, and we know that those are most effective when they're combined with some sort of counseling. So, really, what we encourage people to do, if they're looking to quit tobacco products, is to call 1-800-QUIT-NOW. That's the state's tobacco quit line that provides free help, and it also provides free starter kits of those nicotine replacement therapies that I mentioned a second ago.
And Spencer, the Department of Health Services also just relaunched a campaign about e-cigarettes and vaping among young people, the Tobacco is Changing campaign. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. So we launched the Tobacco is Changing campaign originally in 2017, and then we modified it because we saw the popularity of Juul products was really taking off and felt like the campaign needed to reflect that. And for listeners that maybe haven't heard about Juul products, Those are a brand of e-cigarettes, and there are many different sort of offshoots of them. But it's important to know that with them and with other types of e-cigarette products, they don't necessarily look like an e-cigarette. They could look like a USB flash drive. They can look like a highlighter, other items that you might find in the classroom. And so really, the campaign focuses on e-cigarettes and other types of tobacco products, many of them flavored with candy and fruit flavors. We really want to expand parents' perspective because if they think that just talking to their kids about not smoking has them covered with the tobacco talk, we really want to try to change that perspective to get them thinking and talking about the other types of tobacco products that we're seeing gain increasing popularity with youth. And parents can learn more about that at tobaccoischanging.com.
And Tom, if is the Department of Health Services giving an advisory for people about using these products in general? Are they considered safe right now when you don't know kind of what the connection is?
Well, I think Spencer can answer that a little better than I can, but it certainly makes people think, you know, what we're going through. Again, the severity of the illness, you know, that we think is probably directly related to vaping. Parents and students and teenagers have to realize that this is a real possibility, and until we identify a source, that danger is still out there. So, again, I just wanted to again thank you, Judith, for helping us to get our message out to the public. It's very important.
Well, thank you both so much for joining us today. Tom Haupt is a research scientist at the Wisconsin Department of Health Services. Spencer Straub is the media and communications coordinator for the Tobacco Prevention and Control Program at the Department of Health Services. Thank you both. They were with us today to talk about the hospitalization of 11 young people in Wisconsin that state health officials think may be related to vaping and e-cigarette use. Coming up, we talk about public art projects going on around Wisconsin, and we want to hear from you. What have you seen where you live? Tell us all about it at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or you can email us at ideas@wpr.org. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. Coming up, we want to hear about public art in your community. Are there murals, sculptures, maybe topiaries, or other types of art where you live that others should see? What does it add to your community and to your life? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email us at ideas@wpr.org. Right now, it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a story about someone who draws under the radar.
On a recent summer afternoon, Nishant Jen, also known as the sneaky artist, sat down in an Eau Claire park. In front of him, couples reclined on the grass and split fish tacos. Three children passed a sticky bottle of orange soda back and forth. Dogs sniffed curiously at each other. Jen uncapped his pen and began to draw.
There's a lot of beautiful things all around us. Sneaky art is my way of appreciating beauty in these ordinary things, like today here, an ordinary place and ordinary people living ordinary lives. But I feel like I've learned this as from watching them and from trying to make art of it, is that even in these ordinary lives, all of us, like, we're locked in these moments of just accidental beauty, not something that was planned, but something that's just there, and in the way they're standing, in the way they're talking to each other. I think it's my duty to record that art. My name is Nishant Jain. Well, I've been drawing all my life, I feel, but I really started doing this as a means of learning how to draw better. I used to draw stick figures. This is 2015. Just the circle with four lines for the arms and one for the body. That's it. And that was the extent of my drawing ability. But I wanted to learn how to draw better. So since 2015, 2016, I put myself through this regimen where I walk around wherever I live, whichever town I'm in, and I walk around and I try to draw everything I see as a means of learning how to draw. I grew up in a city of the city of Calcutta in India, the East. Very regular Indian life. And I studied engineering in my undergrad as a lot of people of my generation did. That was the most standard education to get because it guaranteed you a job. I was about 2 years into my PhD program, halfway through, when it just struck me that I'm wasting too much time. I'm trying to get a degree that I don't really care for, that if left to me entirely, I would not pursue further. So that's when I decided that I was going to quit. I credit that to the US a lot, seeing the people here and the way they chase after their passions. That really gave me the courage to do the same. When I draw people and I look at them, a lot of these people are very, very alien to me, and I can't even imagine how alien I am to them. But the act of drawing them, although it doesn't work reciprocally, but it does bring me a lot closer to them in a sense. And I appreciate that fact. It makes it easier for me to be out here. Even though I don't know anybody, I feel friendlier towards them. Even though it's not my town, it's not my countryside, it's not my part of the world in any sense, I feel like having drawn all the lines of all the things over here and those lampposts a dozen and a hundred times, in a way I can feel like this, I understand it. It can be more homely. Seeing the world through different people's eyes helps you appreciate a lot of the things that you take for granted. And that's what I want people who enjoy my art to feel.
That was Nishant Jain, the sneaky artist based in Eau Claire. His story came to us from Clara Napert, an intern at WPR's Eau Claire office. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Want to make sure you catch every single Wisconsin Life story? Subscribe to our podcast. And find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook. I'm Maureen McCollum.
Now, lots of communities have cool public art that adds to life there for residents and visitors. And we want to hear about public art in your community. Are there murals or sculptures or maybe some temporary art where you live that others should make a point of seeing? What does it add to your community? And do you make a point of going out of your way to enjoy it? Have you run across interesting art in places you've visited in Wisconsin? Tell us all about it. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email us at ideas@wpr.org. And let's go to the phones, and Tekla in Beaver Dam is up. Hi, Tekla.
Hi, how are you doing?
Good. How are you?
Good. Well, I am calling actually from right near one of our beautiful murals here in downtown Beaver Dam. And in 2017, we had 15 murals painted by a group called Wall Dogs, which is a national organization of volunteer artists who will come to different communities. And there are three or four Wall Dog communities here in Wisconsin, Plymouth, Delafield, obviously Beaver Dam. And they come mostly to smaller communities, and you do have to raise funds to buy each mural. But if you have a mural fest like we did in 2017, they do it for a reduced cost. But the majority of the artists who come are volunteers. You just are paying for the design and the materials for the art. But really what it has done for our community is get the community to focus on downtown again. Hmm. And in the past 2 years, there's been a lot of interest in downtown revitalization. And this past summer, we just added another mural, completely community-based. The community on the Saturday that we had it could come and actually paint the mural itself. And the design of the mural is something that will encourage people like to take selfies, and they can put themselves into that particular mural.
Oh, that's so cool. Can you describe it for us? What is the image of it?
Oh, the new mural is shadows of people walking. And it's young people, old people, children, a person in a wheelchair, and it's just their shadows.
Oh, wow. And you said these are in downtown, right?
In downtown Beaver Dam. And if you come to visit, many of our downtown businesses have mural maps. The mural map is also available on the internet site, Downtown Beaver Dam, Inc., Downtown Beaver Dam, Inc.
Great. Well, thank you so much, Tekla, and I'm going to have to make a trip for that. That sounds great. Central Time producer Rachel Vasquez says that when she was moving to Madison and looking for a place to live, she saw a mural on the east side of town, and it was one of the things that helped her decide which neighborhood she wanted to live in. She says she loves the way art brightens up a neighborhood, and I think that's really true, and it sounds like that was what Tekla was saying about living in Beaver Dam and having those murals, too. You can give us a call at 800-642-1234. Employees of the Ideas Network are big fans of public art. Jana Rose said that Wausau's peace sculpture is something that she walked past every day when she lived in Wausau, and she has fond feelings towards it and enjoys it as public art. Andrea Anderson says there's a brand new public mural of Chief Blackhawk in Janesville, and she says it's a huge thing for our community. So bright. It's a great story behind it and so beautiful. And Cheryl Gasser, the Ideas Network director, loves the sculpture Milwaukee exhibit. Lisa Nalbandian, director of Major and Planned Giving, says her community in Wauwatosa loves the murals that have gone up as part of a new public art installation. Lots of murals to be seen. And we still want to hear from you. You can email us at ideas@wpr.org. Share the public art that's in your community and why you love it, and we'll try to get out there and see it. Coming up, a guest political scientist joins us to talk about how the modern American presidential campaign got so long. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Judith Sears-Boisson, in for Rob Ferret. Coming up tomorrow after 6:30 on The Morning Show, in the latest sign of increased pressure on the National Rifle Association, three of its board members resigned last week after calling for an investigation into the group's finances. Kate Archer-Kent and her guests discuss the influential gun rights organization and the strain it faces from legal and internal pressures. That's tomorrow morning at 6:30 here on the Ideas Network. Now, we're still more than a year away from the 2020 presidential election, but already the race is in full swing. More than 20 Democratic hopefuls are competing for the opportunity to take on President Trump, and they've already met for two rounds of debates. It's easy to feel like presidential races drag on forever in this country, where as many other countries have tightly controlled campaign windows, the American presidential election seems to begin immediately after the previous election comes to a close. Our next guest says it didn't used to be this way and is here to explain how we got to this point. Rachel Payne Caulfield is a professor of political science at Drake University, and her recent piece for the website The Conversation is How Did the Presidential Campaign Get to Be So Long? Rachel, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
Well, you are in Iowa, ground zero for any candidate seeking the presidency. No big surprise that this might feel very immediate for you. Do you feel like you are living in a never-ending presidential campaign?
I certainly do. And quite literally, we are living in a never-ending presidential campaign at this point.
And you say that it has not always been this way, but it really does feel like the modern presidential campaign starts immediately after the previous election comes to a close. There is immediately, well, who's going to position themselves for 4 years from now? And while no candidate officially announces right away, moves are made to fundraise, build name recognition, put campaign teams together, how much is going on behind the scenes before a candidate can even begin a real campaign?
Well, a lot of this is going on behind the scenes long before the public starts paying attention. And, you know, I'm reminded of right after the 2004 election, literally within 2 weeks of the general election, John Kerry was back out in Iowa meeting with activists, kind of figuring out if maybe he wanted to do it again. So candidates, once the general election happens, the next round of candidates immediately starts thinking about how they want to position themselves, how they want to talk about issues, what kind of support they would have in the early states, what kind of agenda they want to set, who they need on their team. So it starts much before most people pay attention. Nonetheless, you know, now we're seeing all across the country people are very much paying attention and tuning into debates, and we are 400-plus days away from the general election.
I know, actually, from personal experience, that the United States is a bit of an anomaly here. I have been in France during a presidential election, and you could almost not know that it was going
right
on. Can you give us a sense how other countries handle election campaigns and how much time they set aside for them?
Sure. So in general, most countries that hold national elections, they generally don't last more than 2 months' time. Canada had a very long election by Canadian standards. It lasted about 75 days. And a lot of people started to get concerned about that and saying, this is just, you know, we've gone around the bend. These are long elections now, but they average about 50 days in Canada. In France, it lasts about 2 weeks. Japan restricts campaigns to just 12 days. And then, you know, Mexico, which is a little bit closer to the U.S. system in that they have a presidentialist system, so they might be expected to pay more attention to the selection of their chief executive. But they have 90 days for the presidential campaign, and they have a 60-day preseason where they select candidates. It's kind of what we would consider a nomination campaign. So the U.S. is really very different than most other democracies.
Well, and besides the amount of time, there is also the element of how many ways the campaigns or the candidates are getting in front of the voters. Because again, I'll refer to France because it's the one I know the best. Mm-hmm. There are no television ads, and
right,
when I've tried to explain political robocalls to people, they look at me like I'm not from this planet. So that's part of it too. It's very controlled.
Yeah. So what has happened over time in the United States is that we have enacted a series of reforms that have democratized the process. They've aimed to bring more and more people into the party's selection of its nominee. And, you know, they had the laudable goal of really spreading around the influence. So a lot of different kinds of voters now get to participate in a very public process. But in doing that, what it means is campaigns are incentivized to go out and to reach as many people as possible. And the way they do that is through advertising. Advertising requires money, of course, through free media. So they might try to make statements and kind of be out front on national issues, which we're seeing right now in the wake of the mass shootings over the weekend. They might engage in targeted Facebook ads, right? And I have to tell you, as an Iowa voter, I've already received 4 or 5 text messages today from campaigns encouraging me to attend events and meet their candidates. So they become very targeted at reaching out to as many people as possible. They have to be very savvy, and they have to have mass appeal now very early in the process.
Rachel Payne Caulfield is with us. She's a professor of political science at Drake University, and we are talking about the topic of her recent piece for the website The Conversation, that is, how did the presidential campaign get to be so long? And Rachel, you say it wasn't always this way. So can you take us back to earlier days of American elections? What did they look like then?
Sure. At the very beginning, candidates were selected by members of the party who were in Congress. It was called the Congressional Caucus or the King Caucus. And there was no public campaign at all. And that quickly shifted to this national convention system. So party leaders from all the different states would gather at a convention and select the party nominee. These were the days of the so-called smoke-filled rooms, right, where the elites would get together and make a decision about who the best standard bearer for the party would be. And then you know, as we moved into the middle of the 20th century, states started to experiment with a much more public primary process rather than these party elite gatherings. And so that primary, the primary became much more important, and campaigns started engaging in advertising and direct voter outreach much more. But even by 1952, you know, Dwight Eisenhower on one side of the aisle, he didn't even announce that he was a Republican until 10 months before the general election. And when he did, he said, yeah, I might be willing to be president, but he didn't declare a candidacy. You know, and then it wasn't until June, before the general election, he resigned as NATO commander and came back to actually campaign. So, you know, a very short campaign for him. And then on the Democratic side, Adlai Stevenson had been encouraged to run for president by the president, President Truman, and he repeatedly rejected those efforts. He said, nope, don't want to be drafted into this race. I don't want nothing to do with it. But he gave a speech at the opening of the convention, and the delegates got so excited about him that they chose him as the nominee. So it wasn't until the party convention that they chose the nominee. So very different environment than the one that we expect today.
Well, and speaking of conventions, some listeners may remember the Democratic Convention of 1968 or have heard about it. It was very contentious. Tens of thousands of protesters on the streets of Chicago, riots, bloodshed. You say that led to a series of reforms. How did the 1968 Democratic Convention affect that nomination process?
Well, first of all, for anyone who's interested in kind of figuring out why our elections work the way they do, if you go back to the late 60s and early 70s, there's just a whole series of reforms that went into effect right around that time period and in reaction to a lot of different events. But the 68 convention was so contentious, and the Democratic Party, you know, even if we set aside all the moral and kind of party questions that came out of that convention, there was a big public relations problem that the party faced in that it had a lot of young, energized anti-war protesters who supported Eugene McCarthy, who had protested in the streets of Chicago as Hubert Humphrey was nominated, and Mayor Daley's police force came out and to quell those protests, and it ended up being very violent. It was on TV screens all across the country. And so the Democratic Party formed a committee and said, okay, how are we going to solve this? How are we going to make our process more accessible to a wider range of people? And they put into effect a series of reforms, the McGovern-Fraser reforms, after that 68 convention. And those reforms were really designed to make it easier for people to participate. If you lived in a caucus state like Iowa, you had to have local caucuses, so they were easy to attend. And a lot of state party organizations said, this is a huge logistical nightmare, so we're just going to switch over to primaries. We're going to, you know, have the state run these things, and it's going to be easy, easy for people to participate. And in doing that, it created an environment where campaigns now really did have to go out, and they had to use any tool at their disposal to gain support from as many people as possible. So it wasn't enough to just, you know, spend time with and convince the party leaders. You now had to get the rank and file voters to like you. And that meant a lot of time and effort. It meant a lot of strategic use of media, a lot of fundraising. And all of a sudden, you had a very different election environment that came out of that series of reforms.
Well, and another change, Rachel, it sounds like was, as you said, being in Iowa, you are constantly being campaigned at. Mm-hmm. New Hampshire is in a similar situation, and that came out of Jimmy Carter's success.
It did. So one of the things, after those 68 reforms were enacted, Iowa had already changed its caucus system to make it more local, and so they started mapping back from the national convention to find out when they would need to hold these local caucuses. And it turned out that Iowa would have to hold these local caucuses really early in the process, in fact, before New Hampshire. And New Hampshire has had the first in the nation primary for a decade, for a century, sorry. And so Iowa all of a sudden went before New Hampshire. 1972, McGovern, who had written these rules, McGovern paid some attention to Iowa, did fairly well, but was not considered to be a big victor. And then in 1976, Jimmy Carter said, you know what, if I can bet everything on Iowa and I can go out there and knock on doors and meet with people in their workplaces and in their, you know, in their restaurants and diners and really get to know them and let them get to know me, I can do well in Iowa, and that in turn will provide a great deal of momentum for my campaign going forward. And that's exactly what he did. And so that mythology of Iowa then became a really big deal. And more candidates sought to emulate that by coming to Iowa very early on in the process to build that person-to-person contact that would allow them to do well in the early states.
We're talking right now about how modern American presidential campaigns became so long. Rachel Payne Caulfield is our guest. She's a professor of political science at Drake University. And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Are presidential campaigns too long, in your opinion? Or does a longer campaign make you feel more engaged and help you cast an informed vote? What do you think would improve presidential campaigns? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation in just a bit here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. We're continuing our conversation with Rachel Payne Caulfield. She's a professor of political science at Drake University, and we're talking about how the presidential campaign season became so long in the United States, especially compared to other countries. And you can join in with your thoughts at 800-642-1234. In advance of the 2020 election, do you have campaign fatigue already? Are these campaigns too long or just about right? Could anything be done to speed them up? Give us a call at 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. And Rachel James on Facebook wrote, we should have a federal law requiring all presidential primaries and caucuses to be held on the same day, preferably sometime in July of the election year. Is that a viable option for cutting down the election length?
Well, so I think, first of all, this is a pretty common proposal to say, okay, we're just going to do this nationally. One of the things, you know, when we talk about any reform, we have to think about not only what the benefits would be, one of which might be a shorter campaign season, but also what are the unintended consequences. And one of the things that we've seen this with front-loading, as more and more states have moved their races up, is that when candidates have to compete in a lot of states all at the same time, and that's certainly what would happen under some form of a national primary or a national day of primaries, it means that candidates essentially would have to start a national campaign straight out of the gate. They'd have to be ready to run in every single state. And I suspect that what a lot of candidates would do is they would come earlier and earlier and start raising more and more money because it costs a lot to run a national election. So I think they depend more heavily on media, even more than they do now. That requires a lot of money. So they'd be seeking money very early in the process.
And Johan on Facebook wrote, the campaign might be long, but with all these candidates, you want to be sure all of them get time to say what their plans are. That's just how fairness works. Is there something to be said for, especially when, you know, we had 24 Democrats at first, is there something to be said for making sure voters have a chance to learn about them?
Well, I think everybody wants to know what the choices are in a campaign. And one of the things that's been unique about these debates is that we've seen so many candidates so early on, and a lot of people across the country, they're not accustomed to seeing that many voices on stage at a time. Part of that's because we have such a huge field of Democrats running this cycle, and part of it's simply because we're airing debates on a national level earlier and earlier in the process. And so, yeah, I think it's worth hearing all of those voices. There is a plan in place. As the debates continue, the thresholds will get higher and higher. So there's a plan in place to start to winnow that field and get an idea of who's a viable candidate and who's not. And I think at this point, so many people felt overwhelmed by those debates that it gives you a good idea about exactly how diverse the ideas within a single party can be.
Is the 2020 presidential campaign likely to be the longest we've seen to date? And is it possible for them to get even longer in the future?
It's possible for them to get longer in the future. There's always a little gamesmanship between Iowa and New Hampshire to potentially, go earlier and earlier for several cycles now. There's been some speculation that Iowa may end up having to go in the year prior to the general election. That hasn't happened, and the parties have kind of tamped down on that. But certainly, if a candidate or a potential candidate is starting to think about the possibility of running, they want every advantage they can get, and they want it as early as possible. And just as evidence of that, John Delaney, this time around, he actually announced his bid for the White House before the midterm elections occurred. So he has been out in Iowa now for a year and a half talking to Iowa voters, and that's a remarkable shift. We've not seen anything quite like that before.
Let's go to the phones, and Oliver in Madison is up. Hi, Oliver.
Hello, how are you?
Good.
So my comment was this. I thought was to take the national census data, then break it down a step so that you would have it by state, then choose the state every 10 years that is most reflective of the country as a whole to go first. So it wouldn't always be Iowa.
Hmm.
This would also allow the candidates to find out how they're actually going to do on a mass scale that's representative of the national numbers.
That's an interesting idea, Oliver. Is that something that you've heard a version of before, Rachel?
Well, there's always kind of this conversation about how to choose a representative state. And there are, I think, a lot of good reasons to think about how can we set up a process that accurately represents the wide and incredibly diverse range of viewpoints within the American political system. One of the reasons, I live in Iowa, so obviously I'm a big fan of the Iowa caucuses, but I'm a little biased on this front, I'll admit that. But I also think, most states in the United States right now are not competitive from a partisan perspective. Iowa remains competitive. Any ideology can find a home here in Iowa. So candidates that might seem nationally to be representative of some characteristics, in most states in the country, they actually don't have much of a fighting chance because of the nature of partisan politics in so many states. And I would also just note there are a lot of states that are very demographically diverse and very representative of the population at large, but they're states that have very big media markets. They're states where candidates would really rely on media much more. That just changes it changes the kind of candidate who will be successful in the process. I think anytime we talk about these reforms, we need to think about whether or not they will achieve our intended effects, but whether they also have some potential unintended effects.
Well, Rachel, thank you so much for joining us today. It was a really interesting conversation.
Well, thank you.
Rachel Payne Caulfield is a professor of political science at Drake University. Her recent piece for the website, The Conversation, is How Did the Presidential Campaign Get to Be So Long? You can share your thoughts on that topic over on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Let us know if you think it's too long, too short, or just right. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, conspiracy theories have been around for a long time, but are looking a bit different today. We'll talk to an author about why she says the new conspiracism is a threat to democracy. Being able to speak another language can be useful for work and travel and can also just be a lot of fun. We'll talk about the joys of learning another language at any age. And PBS has a new kids show that features a Native American girl living in Alaska. We'll talk with the creators of the new show, Molly of Denali. That's coming up tomorrow on Central Time. Weekdays from 6 to 9 a.m., it's the morning show. Tomorrow after 7, it's estimated that 1 in 4 pregnancies ends in miscarriage. Even though it's common, understanding miscarriage and talking about it remain difficult for many. Kate Archer Kent talks with a psychotherapist and author about the physical and emotional toll of miscarriage and how we can all better support those who have experienced it. That's tomorrow morning at 7 here on the Ideas Network. Coming up next, it's the news from NPR and WPR, and then it's easy to blow things out of proportion when they go wrong. We'll talk with a Wisconsin anger expert on how to avoid what he calls catastrophizing. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, in for Rob Ferret. This is Central Time.